Welcome to Bombshell. I'm Erin Simpson.
I'm Radha Iyengar.
And I'm Lauren DeYoung Shulman. And we are doing another, you know, separated on opposite sides of the coast version of Bombshell. But this week,
this time,
Erin and Radha are together. Together.
Yay!
Again.
I have company.
In San Francisco. We're
drinking coffee. Maybe you're drinking something more interesting, Lauren.
I am.
But we're eating Pop-Tarts for breakfast.
Oh, God, that's amazing.
I'm
what
really
kind?
I'm really excited about this.
Not just
this.
Any Pop-Tarts, guys. Cinnamon frosted Pop-Tarts. Because why really pretend with the fake fruit? I feel like just go all the way.
Cinnamon brown sugar, right?
Obviously.
Right, yeah, yeah. That was my, when I worked in the Pentagon, that was my chosen, I don't have actual food, but I'm going to get this as my meal. It was always a toss-up between that and Famous Amos cookies, but I found brown sugar Pop-Tarts really kind of satisfied in a way that Famous Amos cookies could not.
I used to eat these Pop-Tarts basically every night after 10 p.m. my freshman year and sophomore year in college. So I'm really enjoying this throwback situation.
I went through an entire college phase where all I ate was cinnamon brown sugar Pop-Tarts and Cinnamon Toast Crunch. Is very cinnamony. So
we are role models for the ages.
Yep. Very spicy. Very spicy.
You guys can all aspire to be just like us. Speaking of role models.
Yeah.
We have a Future of Statecraft conference at CSIS coming up.
We do, on April 2nd, organized by several friends of the show, or we are friends of their show. Hard to say which came first. That will be featuring all of us in some way or another. So please, if you're not already registered for that, you should totally come. It's going to be amazing. Radha, you're like doing a panel.
I am doing a panel. I'm moderating a panel on economic stuff. So if you feel like you don't get enough economic stuff here, just you wait.
And then my former boss, Ambassador Susan Rice, will be doing a keynote discussion with Kath Hicks. So the whole day is going to be fabulous. You should definitely go.
That's going to be fantastic. So speaking of also amazing, we had like a very nice shout out last week from the kind folks at Wired UK. We don't know who these people are.
We don't. If you,
I mean, we know what Wired UK is.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Right. But like, if you can tell us,
we just don't know the specific person who or persons who listened to our podcast and got everyone at Wired UK to listen to it and vote for us. So,
so we were told that we were the top 30 podcasts that make you think.
Curious minds.
Okay. Yeah. So we are apparently, I guess, you know, an interesting podcast and other people should listen to us. But if you are the Wired UK person who put us up for that, please let us know who you are so that we can say thank you. Because that was a really delightful way to wake up in the morning.
It really was. Compared to all the ways you can wake up on Twitter. That was certainly among the better ones.
It really was. It also let people in my organization be like, oh, I guess your podcast is kind of a big deal. Like, yeah. Yeah. Thanks, guys.
Yeah, but Radha and I were both hoping that nobody noticed.
Meantime, my parents asked me, like, wait, what's the podcast? How do I listen to that? So,
Aww. Yeah.
On the other hand, my mom listens to us every 2 weeks and then complains that she can't join the conversation, which I consider to be a feature, not a bug. Sorry, Mom.
Maybe next Mother's Day, which I guess is pretty soon, actually.
Yeah.
Oh, indeed. Just think about that.
Yep.
All right.
Okay, but instead, we're going to talk about all kinds of crazy world events and
crazy
political.
Train.
The crazy train. but we're going to start with It's a Guest.
Shall we start in China?
We shall.
Folks may remember we are in the middle-ish of a trade war.
Ish.
Right. We have about We have tariffs on about $250 billion worth of Chinese goods. They've taxed our goods. We were in the middle of trade negotiations. The parties thought they had come to a reasonably close agreement. And then there was a slight pause in the discussion, largely centering around how we were going to have enforcement mechanisms / what the penalties were should China in particular be caught violating the agreement, with particular concerns to how China gets access to trade secrets and manages sort of IP. So that's like the big sticking point. So we had a 2-week pause in negotiation. Robert Lighthizer and Steve Mnuchin of fame, holding up a giant bill of money with his wife like an evil cartoon villain, also known as the Treasury Secretary.
Are
heading to Beijing this week. You know, President Xi issued a statement sort of in late February ahead of the pause, being optimistic. we've got this very senior U.S. delegation coming. The vice premier from China is then going to come to the U.S. in early April. So all of that looks positive until, dun, 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 the president announced on TV in an interview that he was planning to keep 50 billion of the 250 billion in tariffs or in goods that are tariffed, even after we sign a trade deal, but doesn't want China to retaliate by keeping any tariffs on us. So the deal would be we sign a trade deal, they remove all of their penalties on our goods, we remove some, even many, but not all of the penalties on their goods, and then, you know, we all hug and go home. It seems like that might not be a great deal for the Chinese, but that's kind of, you know, that's kind of where we are.
I appreciate the transparency of, you know, I said I was going to do a deal with you guys. I'm kind of reneging. Here's how I'm going to renege. We're all cool, right?
It's like a process. Is that a process?
It's like a boyfriend who openly cheats on you, but like tells you about it.
It's kind of just like that. And maybe this time he'll change.
Maybe this time he will change, but probably not.
So funny little side note, as the reporting was happening on the China trade deal, it's come to light that the president had been negotiating on the European side related to these auto tariffs we had put on. The Europeans had offered this, hey, how about you don't tariff our goods? We won't tariff, you don't tariff our cars. We won't tariff your cars. The president was like, well, that's not fair. Because Europeans are never going to buy Chevys the way that they buy the Americans buy Mercedes. And so he's not wrong, but it seems like we're in a really weird space where fair deals are now not good deals.
Well, right. He doesn't want a fair deal. He wants an advantageous deal to the U.S. and doesn't have any leverage to get one. So
it's not true. He has Twitter.
Yeah. Well, we'll get back to that in a few minutes. He's been doing a lot of tweeting lately.
So I guess the Europeans maybe have bigger things to worry about right now.
They do, as a matter of fact, as we keep up some foreign relations. So from what I can tell, I tried not to pay attention to Brexit because things were not doing anything and moving forward last week. But from what I understand, that some part of the UK military is now like in a bunker awaiting nuclear war of some kind. That seems about right, right?
Yeah, that seemed a little overwrought in terms of the reporting from the British press. But it was an eventful week for Brexit, even though I guess some things did actually happen. So one of the things that happened is maybe 10 days ago now, the Speaker of the British House, who's the guy with the terrible ties, who says, order, order, very loudly, basically invoked a rule from the 1600s. To refuse to allow Theresa May to reintroduce her plan for like the third time.
Can I introduce that in my marriage?
I mean, you are welcome to try.
I will order. No, you cannot propose the same thing I said no to.
We can stand in the background and wrap our knuckles on the table if it helps.
Yep, that would that'll work. Yep.
And so government was just sort of like left like, wait, what do you mean? Like they were going to try to reintroduce the May's plan. And I actually had to go back and be like, what actually was in the Chequers plan that was originally put forward kind of summer last year and then a little bit more in detail in November of last year. But it's basically a kind of a lengthy exit. It's not an immediate exit. It's not a hard exit. And there remains this sort of like future negotiation over both a free trade agreement and the exact nature of the Northern Ireland border. And because of that, it's basically appeases no parties. Like the hard Brexiteers dislike it. The Remainers also dislike it. And so there's really no center ground here for her to craft votes from. Meanwhile, the parliament has just repeatedly said what it doesn't want as opposed to what it does want. And so after Bercow basically says, no, the prime minister can't reintroduce this bill, Theresa May goes on television and just like lambastes the members of parliament. That did not go over well.
It really did not.
Guys, they're pretty cross.
Yeah.
They're all cross with each other. And who's also cross, I mean, Angela Merkel actually had the best line, which is not something we say very often, which when asked what was going on with Brexit, said that she was not familiar with British parliamentary procedure from the 17th century, but she would have to read up on it. So like, where does that leave us now?
Well, there's a massive protest that
yes.
is going on, right? So there's that piece.
So that was like a rally on Saturday for a people's vote, which is essentially the nice name for a second referendum, which in some ways seems, I don't know, like we've revisited this question enough times already, but would be a specific vote on the May plan, like up or down on Theresa May's particular plan. Which would be somewhat different from the original referendum. But instead, the Europeans have granted them partial reprieve. So the hard date had been March 29th, and they've now said that they can have until May 22nd if the parliament approves Theresa May's plan. But if they don't approve the plan, the new crash out date is like April 12th, which also seems like the most convoluted way to grant an extension and like perfectly right. on brand for this particular drama.
It's basically like when you're giving your long-term boyfriend a deadline to propose. This is my Lauren moment, guys.
Nice. That was great. Keep going.
Experience was like, I mean, my exact reaction to this experience was like, oh, this is just like you give your boyfriend, you have to propose by this date or we're breaking up. And then you get really close to the date and you're like, okay, look, here's the thing. I know you didn't get your shit together. So I'm going to give you 2 more weeks. But in 2 weeks, if you don't propose, I'm really going to break up with you. It's like kind of hard to know, like, is that credible? Is it not? But at some point, you know, it's either going to be propose or break up. So I feel like that's kind of where we are with Brexit. Propose a plan or let's just rip the Band-Aid off, pack up our stuff and go to our separate corners.
So the thing I'm not fully understanding on this desired people's vote is, if the people voted against the May plan, then what? Because they appear to be saying, no, actually, we don't like Brexit, but correct. Then leaving themselves to Brexit harder. Yes?
Yep. Or to rescind Article 50.
Okay.
There was actually, we'll put it in the show notes. There was a pretty good BBC article with a literal flow chart at the bottom. Although there was a lot of like question marks.
Right. Like, other who knows?
So
maybe Thomas Cromwell introduced something into parliamentary procedure like 600 years ago that we just don't know about yet that is going to change everything going forward. If I was a member of parliament, I would 100% be reading up on like, how can I screw with this now?
Also, definitely, I'm sure there are non-codified common law procedures that could be adopted in Britain. So I'm really looking forward to like, is there a British lawfare? There should be someone, guys, rational security.
If there's a British lawfare, raise your hand.
But just to sort of close out the thoughts on this, one note is part of the reason the general population is freaking out is not just the sort of like tariffs and mobility issues which will happen, but basically there are a whole bunch of just procedural things that have to happen when Brexit happens, even if everyone agreed to no tariffs in terms of like barriers and checks at borders that sort of impede and slow down trade flows. So the British government hasn't been sort of staffed to manage the flow of European goods and services in that kind of market because they haven't had open borders. There's no indication that they're actually like doing a planning for like.
No, it's still a total cluster.
So I think there's like, you know, whether it's May 22nd or April 12th, there's going to be this real a bunch of frictions at the border, regardless of tariffs, that are probably mean you should buy some shelf-stable milk and bread if you're in the UK.
The Pentagon could really learn a lot from the UK in terms of shirking. You know, you were asked to do something, you're not going to do it. How badly are you not going to do it? I think the UK is doing it that spectacularly right now in a way that the Pentagon should really try to emulate.
You don't mean that.
No, I don't.
Okay, so one other hot item in keeping up foreign relations is upcoming Israeli elections, which I'll be honest, I had not been following closely until some recent White House mayhem this week, which we'll get to in a second.
OMG! Like, they are so fascinating this year.
Yeah, I mean, so, I don't know, I mean, do you guys usually follow Israeli politics?
I mean, like, in the sense that Bibi Netanyahu has been prime minister, I feel like since I was born, but that is not true. But just for
it turns out he's been prime minister for 10 years. I had to look it up because I was like not really believing it. It's a crazy long time in Israeli politics, given how volatile their coalitions tend to be. So 10 years is forever, which means he both has like a weird record,
particularly without having an actual war.
Well, you know, that too.
Right.
Very interesting. So when are the elections?
Elections are April 9th. And while I think probably 6 months ago, pretty much no one thought that there was any real possibility that Netanyahu's party technically would be defeated in the elections, there are some interesting coalition building, political dynamics, and also legal dynamics going on right now that could result in Netanyahu maybe not getting as much support as otherwise desired. He is under a variety of investigations right now for things that seem kind of not that big a deal in the grand scheme of things, given U.S. politics, but are still having some impact there.
Yeah, so this is not the first set of corruption charges that Netanyahu has faced in the last 10 years, but there are three different cases that his own attorney general is basically, I guess in our language, he has not been indicted yet, but they've indicated they plan to bring charges.
And like really senior staff have been indicted or something, right?
Yeah, it's like not a great situation.
Though it has many parallels.
But there's this new coalition kind of on the opposition side called the Blue and White Party, which is actually led by three former chiefs of defense or chiefs of the army, which is very interesting from a civil military relations perspective. Israel's dynamics on that are very different from our own. But they are giving Likud and Netanyahu a real run for their money. And it's sort of been a pretty nasty race, it looks like. And so, you know, as Lauren indicated, like it's not a presidential election. You're not voting for one person. You're voting for the party. And then that party puts coalitions together. And I guess there was a poll in the Jerusalem Post that this Blue and White Party is doing better than Likud, but the overall coalition partners, it would be easier for Netanyahu to put a coalition together. So there's always sort of this weird kingmaking that goes on after the elections.
Yeah, and that could take easily through the summer. You may end up with a result where, you know, for instance, perhaps Netanyahu remains prime minister, but perhaps maybe commits to only staying in power for a limited period of time. And some of those folks who are heading up the other coalition can end up in senior posts, like in the foreign ministry or defense or otherwise, and kind of trade out at some point. Or you could see an actual defeat of Netanyahu. What's going to be interesting to see is how much he continues to pursue policies that are aimed at bolstering his electoral support, but are really potentially offensive to some parts of the Israeli electorate, whether that be something we'll talk about in a minute in terms of the Golan Heights, whether or not he'll take any further action in terms of settlements in the West Bank or, you know, other sort of incursions into Gaza, things that are, you know, frankly, quite sensitive in the Israeli polity, but are, you know, meant to be able to get out the vote for him in a way that it could cause his coalition to succeed.
And maybe sort of partly half keeping up foreign relations and half White House mayhem, there has been a sort of series of wins that he has kind of garnered over time in big issues that do sort of mobilize his base, in particular the Iran deal and the U.S. withdrawal from it was a really big win. And folks might recall he was very against it and remained pretty vocally against it, as well as the movement of the embassy to Jerusalem.
Yeah, for sure. So he's certainly playing his courtship of Donald Trump as a key reason why you should prefer him to any of these other jokers who might, you know, become prime minister. And that takes us right into White House mayhem, which has been quite mayhemic this week.
Quite mayhemic. We are apparently the United States. We are now totally okay with taking over a country, taking over territory that was not its own by force and legally adopting it as its own territory.
Sovereign territory.
We were not usually okay with in the past, but we are now okay with that in the terms of Israeli announcing that they are now considering Golan Heights to be part of their sovereign territory. And the United States is like, yeah, cool. That's great. We like their wine.
Do we like their wine?
I do like their wine.
I've really never had their wine.
Oh, all right.
Noted.
Little side bid there.
I guess as I was reading up on this, you know, one of the things that's kind of interesting here, this is totally symbolic, right? Israel has effectively occupied the Golan Heights for 50 years, and there was no real move for that to shift in a meaningful sense, other than this is sort of, as you were saying, Lauren, an electoral gambit by Netanyahu, and then a pretty willful intrusion on the part of the American White House to play in those electoral politics on a couple of different fronts. Netanyahu is actually coming to the White House next week, which is, again, sort of a way of bolstering his connections to the Americans and meant to give him a hit ahead of the elections in a way that I think Obama declined, did not allow Netanyahu the same opportunity the last time he went through elections.
Yep.
So were just totally taking part, taking sides with a preferred partner in a foreign country's elections, and allowing them to sort of set, you know, effectively annex territory in contravention of several UN resolutions and maybe even the UN charter.
And I think just it's worth noting that it's not that we actually did this as part of some kind of negotiated political deal or an overall strategy in the region. So much like the movement of the U.S. embassy in Israel, which, look, as Aaron said, in substantive sense, Israel has occupied the Golan Heights for a while. So there is, an argument to be made that if this was part of a larger political discussion and diplomatic effort, maybe this is a sort of reasonable chip. But as a gambit by the U.S. president to bolster one party in a foreign election, it is a particularly unique exercise in activity.
Yeah, we're hearing some leaks about what the so-called Kushner plan, Kushner Middle East peace plan, is going to look like. Some component of which is probably going to be Israel formally annexing parts of the West Bank into its own, officially as to be part of Israel, with the Palestinian territories then potentially annexing parts of Jordan, which is sort of a new idea. And then Jordan annexing parts of Saudi Arabia. This all makes a little bit more sense when you look at a map, but frankly, not really. Whether or not this was meant to be a part of that overall plan or was not meant to set a sort of nice legal precedent for Israel in executing such a plan is TBD, because nobody really, really, really knows the details of Kushner's plan, including people who would be key parts of negotiating it. The Palestinians have frankly not really met with Kushner in the last year or so, if not longer than that. The Israelis continue to be part of these discussions. And then, of course, the Saudis are besties and they're on like a WhatsApp group all together hanging out. I'll be curious to see when Netanyahu is in town, if other elements of this plan become public, whether through leaks or formal discussion of that. Of course, AIPAC is this upcoming week, if there's going to be other further discussion of it. It seems like the sort of thing that would be another nice kind of plus to put into Netanyahu's basket from this White House, but they've already done a lot so far, so who knows?
And just as a reminder, I think if I have my history right, that the original owner of the Golan Heights is Syria.
Yes, correct.
So just, you know, side remembering that's who that territory in principle had been annexed from. And obviously there's a whole complicated set of issues dealing with the Syrian government as it currently exists right now. And Nikki Haley, in fact, tweeted about this earlier this week, noting that this is way better than giving back the territory to the, monstrous Assad. Though I'm not sure anyone was suggesting that we also recognize that Israel have to turn over control of the territory. So there's a little bit of a false dichotomy there, but there's this very narrow Syria piece that also kind of gets a little play here.
That reminds me that we don't have an ambassador to the United Nations.
Well, that's right.
It's so fun.
Okay, but speaking of Syria.
Speaking of Syria.
We've defeated ISIS again.
Again.
Guys, I feel like there should be a victory dance or something. Then we get to practice it every couple of weeks when we re-defeat them.
I don't even know.
So, I mean, I think technically we did not defeat them this time. I think it was the Kurds who defeated them this time.
Maybe.
Yeah.
This press release was literally crazy pants. I thought it was from The Onion when I first saw it. I mean, and that's like a pretty high bar at this point in the administration. But
so I had thought, you know, they have these like the real press secretary or something, like where they turn the president's tweets into. So I had thought it was that when I first was reading quotes from the press release. And I was like, oh, okay. You know, we've become so inured sort of to the president saying that. But no, it's an official statement from the White House, like in writing.
Yeah. And it's doesn't match what people are reporting from the ground. I mean, it's a very, on the one hand, you know, we want to debate the president's tweets on this. I mean, this effort consumed years of all of our lives. This was like the most deadly serious thing in the second half of the Obama administration. And now it's just like a set of like Twitter jokes.
And also, I mean, look, we don't need to go down the whole rabbit hole of is territorial control a meaningful assessment of ISIS capability. We could. And like Brian Fishman, who's a friend of this podcast, has written like literally an entire
book. It's not unrelated.
But there is something about the fact that this has become such a like joke that the debate about this centers around the president's Twitter statements and then, frankly, really inappropriate language in a White House press release instead of the substance of what are ISIS's capabilities and what should we and shouldn't we be worrying about? And how does that influence things like how we're spending our money and how we're prioritizing special operations forces and risk we're willing to take? So it's like funny, sad. I'm laugh crying.
I'm laugh crying all amid the president. I still am entirely unclear on how many troops we are leaving in Syria and for what purpose. I believe the last count was 1,000. Originally,
2,000,
it was like
a couple
hundred for peacekeeping purposes, which doesn't make any
sense. We're not going to be transparent about it anyway. So
no, that's true. And now I think we're at like 1,000, again, still sort of TBD in terms of what precisely we are doing there. And I'm awfully dang curious to see what happens when the president hears that, you know, ISIS set off a variety of suicide bombs in Iraq, in Syria, Indonesia, and elsewhere. Is he going to be like, oh, wait, what happened? Or is he going to just, that's just all going to go down the memory rabbit hole? Or are we just going to pretend none of this ever happened?
I mean, and this is part of a broader issue that's frequently difficult, right? I mean, people certainly criticized President Obama with this after the bin Laden raid, which was that the administration was too quick to declare that Al-Qaeda was eradicated and was, you know, we were, you know, peace and prosperity would bloom. It's a genuinely difficult thing. Like, how do you present, you know, bad news essentially to the principal? You know, how do you present intelligence that is contra the existing policy or suggest the current policy is not working? I mean, these are real things that civil servants and political appointees struggle with in every administration. It's totally beyond my mind at this point. Like, how do you go to the president with a revised assessment of ISIS and say they're back, they never left, Mosul's at risk, you know, some version of this, which clearly we must have dealt with in prior administrations, certainly since 9/11 and in other, you know, contexts. But I literally have no idea. I mean, do you just have that conversation at CENTCOM and like not go back to the White House?
I mean, I remember quite specifically, first of all, President Obama's calling ISIS the JV team publicly. And this was not his mm-hmm. own kind of personal assessment. This is what he was being briefed, the intelligence community, who then had to come back to him and say, actually, this has grown in such a way that we are pretty uncomfortable with it and feel as though we need to do something about it. Those were wildly difficult and so awkward conversations to be part of in the White House context. And that was with a responsible, listening president. In this case, I think you probably do a lot of just hiding what you're actually going to do. I think it's easy. We could easily see a lot of Title 50 actions in order to combat any sort of future ISIS threat, or using troops on the ground in a quieter way, perhaps in a coalition, so it's not necessarily attributed to U.S. action, which is not a great way to run a democracy or an all-volunteer force. But we have a president who doesn't want it to be there. So how are we going to manage this?
And I would say, like, this is one of these circumstances where, and I know it's super boring to many people, but the authorities under which the troops are operating there, then by troops, I mean like the folks under Title 10 Department of Defense authorities, like what is their mission and what are they allowed? What are the rules of engagement? Really deeply matter. Because look, there's some argument to be made that we should have learned to stop thinking of territorial control and group capability as like highly correlated or important signals of each other. And we don't, and we keep doing this, and that long predates this administration. But if you have troops there and you have a sort of notion of partnered counterterrorism operations, and that is kind of the direction that these troops are heading in, then maybe there's a responsible set of actions to be had. And if it's a state building, peacekeeping operation, then sort of proactive work against preventing the
regrowth of ISIS. I mean, you could do that in Iraq, though, but you can't do that in Syria. I mean, the Assad government still has sovereignty in Syria.
Avec key partner. We, at this point, are refusing to pay for any sort of Syrian reconstruction.
I mean, look, I don't want to like go too far down this, but you can do it from Iraq. You can do it from lots of places. And there are certainly places in the world where we couldn't, there was either not a willing government partner or not an existent government where we maintained long-term ongoing counterterrorism operations. My point is only that we should be saying that up front and having that discussion as to whether we had it, not declaring victory and then sort of having to backtrack on that and potentially pulling the resources that would allow us to maintain the intel and operational capabilities to respond should you think that the like adversarial capabilities are growing. And no, there's no indication any of that discussion is happening.
And this is where, in the absence of having any kind of NSC process, which we do not, it would be nice if Congress decided to hold a series of hearings on Syria, Iraq, and ISIS, as opposed to just one where everybody gets to make a statement, doesn't really listen to any of the witnesses, and we move on. That's the only way in which Congress is going to be able to reassert its authority here, is to like hold the administration's feet to the fire repeatedly on an ongoing basis, actually learn something, and maybe try to constrain or direct policy in a way that they have not done in the last 20 years.
Yeah, I'm not going to hold my breath. But so on, speaking of no NSC process, let's talk about North Korea.
We have good transitions this episode.
Do we? Do we have sanctions? Do we not have sanctions? What the hell happened?
What are sanctions, really?
So since we didn't get a deal when the president was in, I keep wanting to say Singapore, it was not Singapore, when he was in Vietnam, meeting face-to-face, which I think we were all kind of impressed that he walked away and was like, all right, we don't have a deal. I don't really know how that happened, but that worked out. The next step was to continue to put pressure on North Korea in the form of sanctions, which has been part of the big part of the maximum pressure strategy. So it's a little confusing because we did announce sanctions on a couple of Chinese companies that were doing business with the North Koreans earlier this week. But apparently behind closed doors, there were discussion of like much, much wider sanctions to go forward on North Korea that had not been publicly announced yet, but I guess had been briefed to the president, because he then tweeted that they were canceled, and people
because he thought the chairman of, you know, thought Kim Jong-un was like a good guy.
They fell in love, guys.
They did. I'm totally willing to give the tiniest benefit of the doubt. I don't actually think this happened, but maybe it did, that like this was all part of a strategy that North Korea knew we were building up these sanctions. And then the idea was to be like, look, no, we're really going to do it if you, because about a week and a half ago, North Korea threatened to walk away from any talks in the future going whatsoever. And so maybe part of the deal was we were going to threaten these sanctions and the president was going to say, nope, not going to put them on yet. I'm going to back away from them because I think you're nice and we'll be able to continue to hold this out as a threat. That probably didn't happen, but that's a nice way to look at maybe they had a process.
I mean, I just don't understand how nobody quit when this happened. I mean, this is like, clearly there was some process. There definitely are North Korea hawks in the administration who would like to hold their feet to the fire, who are in favor of maximum pressure, who in fact were quite in favor of it, you know, a year ago now, or a year and a half ago. How do they just like go back to work on Monday after the president has cut them off at the knees? Like, I find that to be completely baffling. I see we have lots of good answers to that question.
my most cynical thought is that Bolton, he doesn't really give a shit about the maximum pressure campaign in terms of sanctions. He's more willing to consider like, all right, well, since we can't do sanctions and they're still not doing what we want, how about some war?
Yeah, I was thinking that you just work on Iran sanctions. Then you can have all the sanctions you want.
Jesus. Copy and paste. Move it over somewhere else.
Too soon.
All this work that you did.
A little soon.
This is, I mean, we are back to square one essentially on North Korea policy, right? Like, it's totally unclear to me, you know, what comes after this sort of failed Vietnam summit, which no one expected to be particularly successful. So it's, I don't know why we're sort of scrambling, but the North Koreans continue to have nuclear capabilities, they continue to have missile capabilities. They're maybe looking to like restart tests, but we're not 100% sure on that. They're kind of minimally compliant with the status quo ante, at least after Singapore. But our leverage is limited, and see also our inability or lack of interest in coercing China to do more on this. So
right. And so just on that note, I mean, I think we're in a tough spot. I think the thing that didn't happen from the Vietnam summit that I think a lot of people had hoped, was myself included, was sort of in bounded sense, at least in agreement that we were all going to like keep talking and right. try to build some relationships, with the thought being like, look, we're probably not going to get substantive compliance or like a full on regime of here's what North Korea is going to do and here's how we're going to sort of trust but verify. But maybe we'd build like the relationship foundation so that when we return to a more process-oriented diplomatic structure in the future, we could build out some of those things, right? Which is not a totally crazy outcome that was at least kind of feasible. Now it just seems like there's a bunch of chaos, with the one caveat being that we do still have some sanctions in place, obviously, and we are like trying to, we impose some economic penalties on these Chinese shipping companies that were doing, apparently I'm the only person in the world who didn't know that they literally like would sail the boats out to the sea and then just like move goods from one flag vessel to a different flag vessel, but sounds crazy and should be in a movie, but
I'm sure it is.
I mean, there is some small kind of enforcement regime. And now I think we're just kind of, we tried the why the hell not strategy. And now we're back to the let's bury our head in the sands and look over there strategy.
Brilliant.
I bet Steve Beegan feels really great.
The president's budget finally came out. It's dead on arrival. Or at least the defense portion is.
Yeah.
Do we have anything more to say on that?
they did more or less what we thought they were going to do. We predicted the last time we actually had a show, which was include a pretty substantial increase in the overseas contingency operations budget, like $150 billion plus OCO budget, on top of the base budget of $500 billion or so, which if you watched any of the hearings in which the acting secretary and the chairman were briefing, pretty much no member of Congress was happy with this solution that they came up with, which is to avoid the Budget Control Act caps of 2012, those came out.
Yep.
So that appears to be dead on arrival. What is nice is that in the actual budget submission itself, unlike prior years, DOD made it really easy for Congress to see what is in the OCO budget and to be able to and see the things that don't belong there. Therefore, making it easy for Congress to say, like, look, clearly this $100 billion makes no sense in OCO. We can see that. You have told us. And we are going to move it over to your regular budget and then we'll debate it from there. My frustration is that, like, I just don't really see either the HASC or the SASC having the mental bandwidth to deal with this. There was other stuff they wanted to do this year. Adam Smith wanted to talk about nukes. They all wanted to talk about use of force issues. There were many things that were not budget shenanigans that they wanted to deal with. So I don't know. Maybe they'll get this all done in a deal behind closed doors quickly so we don't have to have a six-month-long process about whether or not OCO is a good idea. But I don't have my hopes up.
And just one note on like a shorter term impact for this budget discussion, which is folks might remember that we're building a wall from this national emergency.
So, oh, yeah, that's right.
The president had released. So there have been a bunch of legislative moves related to this, with the Congress actually passing something, trying to stop the president and the president vetoing that. In all of that skerfuffle, they had actually released where the money would be coming from. And the answer was basically three big sources, which are the Treasury Forfeiture Fund, which I'll come back to, the counter-narcotics money from the Department of Defense, and then MILCON. And the MILCON is sort of like the funds of last resort, and they did specify...
MILCON means military construction money.
Sorry. Right. And they did specify that military construction wouldn't be service member housing, and have tried to sort of spread it out across a number of places and states and critically political constituencies to mitigate the sort of potential pain. But the deal from the president on that was that, don't worry, you're going to get all this money back because I've put it in my budget, which he seemed to believe or seemed to be suggesting that Congress was just going to sign off on, and that was going to be that. So a bunch of the trade-offs that the Department of Defense and Treasury are going to be making are sort of presumed to be addressed by basically deferring the cost of those activities. In particular, the Treasury Forfeiture Fund, which, guys, is surprisingly interesting, and I won't go into all of the pieces, though Aaron and Lauren got to hear it as we prepped for the show, but is distinct from the Department of Justice Forfeiture Fund, but really critically...
She was so excited to learn this morning,
guys,
I can't even communicate it.
It's so interesting. I will include the recent 2017-2018 IG report on it, which is like really interesting.
Oh, great. Thank you.
But really do read the summary bullet points, though, have a couple of really important things, and one is this... Treasury Forfeiture Fund is actually what they use for investing in technology and analytics related to better understanding and identifying actual criminal financial activity. So there are like real substantive trade-offs that are going to happen here. And those trade-offs, it's not clear they will A, be paid back, especially from the forfeiture fund, which isn't an appropriated fund. It's a fund from seizures from other types of criminal activities. But two, like, those are actually important activities, and there's probably worth a discussion on like what might be happening from them and whether we're comfortable with those trade-offs for a wall.
I believe that is called eating your seed corn.
I think the Commandant of the Marine Corps has some other words for it as well. He was too pleased to have his Milcon taken away after having some real issues at Camp Lejeune and other places. So, yeah, this is, there's very little constituency in the Department of Defense to fund this. And to the extent that they are fairly capable in budget knife fights, I'll be surprised to see just how much of that money ends up going from that perspective. I mean, Congress could do stuff, but you're going to have lots of leaks from senior military officials about how that's going to hurt readiness or service member families or some other number of things.
I'm also looking forward to the leaks from Southcom on the cabin narcotics use of those funds, because it turns out that is their authorities for operations in much of the Southern Hemisphere here on the in the Americas. So fun.
Well, we have all kinds of fun to look forward to.
So, pop culture.
I think it's been kind of a light period for pop culture here. I'm reading Lake Success by Gary Steingart, which is very Gary Steingart. It's quite good, but like requires you to spend a lot of time with some sort of unpleasant people.
Yeah, totally. Aaron, I've been getting my fix of, I don't know, old school dance music, as my husband has trained our son to have a rock off dance contest to things like Jump by Van Halen and Crazy Train. So
nice.
That's what we do. It's fun.
I've been reading The Back Channel by Ambassador Bill Burns, former Deputy Secretary of State. It's a great book of U.S. diplomatic history and his personal experiences. But if you know Bill Burns at all, please know that it's also at some parts funny, which is a little disturbing if you have spent any time with Bill at all. But it's a delightful and easy read. I am also reading, as a sort of counteraction to that, The Blue Sword by Robin McKinley, which is a young adult girly fiction book. A fantasy book that is just delightful.
Perfect.
And I think Aaron's watching basketball.
Well, I was, but thanks for bringing that up, Radha.
Welcome. That's my version of trash talking, guys. I've done my March Madness duty, and now we never need to do this again.
Great.
All right. Well, we'll see everybody in a couple weeks.
Bye.